Well, I'm speaking to you now then from Psalm 45. Psalm 45, in a verse I'll have as a bit of a reference point that we'll start with, is verse 10. Verse 10, getting on towards the end of the psalm, it says, "Listen, O daughter, consider and incline your ear. Forget your own people also, and your father's house." Let's just think about that verse for a moment. Listen, O daughter, consider. Well, that's what we're doing, aren't we? We're listening to this verse and considering. And it says, incline your ear. And then it tells us about forgetting something or someone's. Forget your own people also and your father's house. Just read you some words from quite a contemporary song, which is based on Psalm 45. Incline your ear, hear now, dear, leave your house, receive your spouse. Daughter, it's time, he's giving the sign. Let the bells chime, turn the water to wine. That captures the spirit of that verse there. It's, if you like, a lady being told to forget her own people, forget her own background, forget her own past, so that she can turn her attention to, her focus upon, her future to the dear man who she's standing beside and who she's becoming one with. An old commentator on Psalm 45 says, "As Christ is at the Father's right hand, so the church is at Christ's right hand, where as his wife she shineth with her husband's beams." And the verses around this verse, halfway through verse 9, speaking to the bridegroom, "At your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir. Listen, O daughter, consider and incline your ear, forget your own people also and your father's house, so the king will greatly desire your beauty, because he is your Lord, worship him." And then it speaks of people coming with a gift, people who you would have thought wouldn't need anybody, the rich among the people seeking favour of this new queen. The royal daughter is all glorious within the palace, all glorious within. Well, what can this verse remind us of? Just some thoughts of other Bible passages or characters. Just look at that verse. Forget your own people also in your father's house. Well, I think of Abraham. Abraham was told to leave his father's house. He was told to leave his place, wasn't he, and go where God would show him. And he had to forget certain people. He had to forget certain things, certain interests. There was something new. Or I think of Jesus, perhaps shocking people, and maybe this may shock us tonight, saying, if someone comes after me, then unless he hates his mother and father, his son and daughter, even his own life, and takes up the cross and follows me, then he can't be my disciple. Which, of course, doesn't mean hatred in its fullest sense, but it is similar to this word forgetting. It's a new focus, which has to involve a stepping back from the old focus and the old attachment. Now, let me speak to you as a church, because the bride of Jesus is the church. And if we say it like this, the church is only being what she should be, what we should be, if its focus is on the person of Jesus. If it is looking to Jesus, looking to the Saviour. How are you doing, Great Ellingham? I don't know, of course, the ins and outs of church life here, but I know that there can be times when a church is distracted from Christ, distracted from Jesus, and needs to, in one way or another, forget it. Whatever it is that's getting in the way, whatever the distraction is, forget it. And turn to Jesus Christ. To do that together as a church. And then individually, Christian people, there are times when there needs to be a forgetting, or sometimes a forgetting of people, in a sense. Like this says, forget your own people and your father's house. Well, is this ever what we have to do? Forget our own people? Forget our own family? Forget our own friends? Forget our own boyfriends or girlfriends or whatever? Well, sometimes there does need to be a stepping away. Sometimes there needs to be a realization that these people in my life are, in one sense, keeping me in the world. I just can't help it. They are. Or my relationship with them is not part of obedience to the Lord. It's not compatible with obedience to the Lord, this relationship, this connection, this involvement. And with courtesy, with respect, with love, with care and lots of prayer, I, in a sense, need to forget them. I need to step away. Or it might be a pursuit, mightn't it? Something which is a thing, something that takes over the mind and the time, and it's entangling the heart so it can't beat freely for Christ. Distracting the mind. And there needs to be a, I must forget it. Forget it. And I must turn my gaze to, I must turn my focus to, I must turn, as it were, my way of life and my future to the bridegroom, to Jesus Christ, to Jesus alone. But the only way we can do that is if we are in touch with who Jesus really is. And this psalm, I don't just want to speak about verse 10, because we need to see something of the glories of Jesus, which this psalm in this prophetic way sets out. Yes, it is in the context of marriage. I suppose it's a bit like in Genesis 2, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. They two shall be one flesh. Well, in this case, it's the woman leaving the daughter, leaving father and mother, cleaving to her husband. But it's a marriage situation. And this psalm, in one way, it reads as if it's a celebration of an ancient Jewish wedding of a king, a royal wedding, a king of Israel. Commissioned to be the official song for that celebration, for that wedding, celebrating the king and then his wife, but starting with the king and very much the glories of the king. And that was the way with Hebrew weddings. Well, certainly more so than our own weddings. Have you ever been to a wedding, a British wedding, and people are just saying, doesn't the bridegroom look beautiful? Splendid. He's a splendid-looking bridegroom. Oh, that suit, that cravat. Oh, where did he get that from? That's just fitted in perfect. And talking about the splendid, and the way he looked at his new bride, the devotion, and all about him. Well, it's more likely to be, didn't the bride look beautiful, isn't it, in our weddings? Here comes the bride. Whereas in the Jewish weddings, it would be more, here comes the bridegroom. So he comes, and the procession of the bridegroom coming to be joined with his wife and to take her back to be with him. And so this psalm reads like that. And yet it can't just be about any old king of Israel having his wedding day. Why can't it just be about any old king? Well, for example, because of verse 6, because it's addressing the bridegroom, the king, and it says, your throne, O God, So God is the bridegroom. Your throne, O God, he's the king who's having his wedding day. Wow, is forever and ever. And then it goes on talking to him and saying, you love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you. Seems to be two parties here, both called God. Well, this is the Trinity, isn't it? Jesus, God, the Son. He is the bridegroom. And he is the one supremely blessed by God the Father. And let us think of some things we can say about Jesus Christ from this psalm. We can say, he is wonderful, delightful, and beautiful. We can say he is a warrior. We can say he is willing. And we can say he ought to be worshipped. The W's there. Wonderful, delightful, and beautiful. A warrior. Willing. Ought to be worshipped. He's wonderful, delightful, and beautiful. Well, how does the psalm start? My heart is overflowing with a good theme. Written from a full heart, this psalm, about a good theme. What is that good theme? I recite my composition concerning the king. Here's the theme. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. These words aren't forcing themselves out of my mouth. I'm not having to think hard and long and hard about every sentence and get it just right. Through lots of hard work and difficult thinking. No, the words are coming out that like a pen that someone just can write word after word, ready to write. And of course, the psalm is inspired. God caused these words to be written as they are. And the penman, the speaker, is speaking God's oracles as God gives him words. But from a full heart, there's so much to say. And let's begin to say it, he's saying, about the king. And he starts with just the character of the king. He is wonderful, delightful, and beautiful. He truly is. Jesus is, isn't he? Wonderful to make us wonder and make us stand amazed. Look up to this great king, this great person of Jesus. Delightful to satisfy the hearts. Beautiful for us to adore him, to enjoy, to delight in who he is, what he's like. And it starts with that beauty. You are fairer than the sons of men. I drove over to Great Ellingham and the evening sky looked so good. There's a goodness about creation, isn't there? And, as well as a beauty. Looking at the sky, I had some music on and it's very nice music, some nature sounds going with the music. At times heard some good-natured laughter, young girls laughing in the back of the car, and I thought, in one sense, I'm looking at the beauty of Jesus, and I'm listening to the beauty of Jesus, because he's the creator. This is showing how beautiful he is. It's from him. All these good things. And yet, to actually see him, and we will on the ultimate wedding day, metaphorical wedding day of being joined to him, we will see him. And to see him and to hear him, his actual voice, to see how he looks in himself and in his glory, in all his nature, shown on his face and in everything about him, we'll know how beautiful he is. It's an inner beauty which is being talked about a lot in Psalm 45, what he loves, what he hates, and so on. You are fairer than the sons of men. Well, that helps us to think of Jesus in comparison to others. It's wonderful to see Christian beauty in other people, to see people who are being changed and who are showing in new ways purity. Pure kindness, devotion to Christ, a depth of their character. And yet, this says you are fairer than the sons of men. That helps us see a little bit of the beauty of Jesus, but you can't compare him with anybody. He's fairer than all. He's fairer than everybody. There's beautiful people But you compare them to Jesus and you say, no, he's the beautiful one. He's fairer than the sons of men. Then we help to think about his lips and his talking and his words. Grace is poured upon your lips. Gracious words. The grace of God just came from his lips. It was all with grace and beauty and honor. And we think of how God sees Jesus. How does God see him? Well, he's blessed him forever. God the Father sees Jesus with only love and delight and approval and favor, and has blessed him forever because he's so wonderful, delightful, and beautiful. He's a king. He's a wonderful king. He's a strong king. His beauty is shown in how he acts as king. And this continues to celebrate that strength. A king with a sword and a throne who rides victoriously and is skillful. So what is his kingdom all about? It's about glory and majesty and truth, faithfulness, humility, and righteousness. That's what his kingdom's all about. And it conquers. And he's God, verse 6, as we said. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. His kingdom is represented by that symbol of a scepter of righteousness. Verse 7, you love righteousness and hate wickedness. Can hatred be beautiful? We'd say no, hatred can't be beautiful. And yet there is a kind of hatred. And if you think about it, you know this is right. There is a kind of hatred that is beautiful. Some things ought to be hated. If someone doesn't hate them, what's the matter with them? So Moses came down the mountain, didn't he? And he saw the golden calf and he realized what the people had done. And he hated the sight of that golden calf. And he lost his temper. Well, that wasn't good. He lost control. But the hatred of it was right. With Jesus, we see a hatred without losing control. It's in control. But it is a pure and right and righteous hatred. And Jesus hated those particular things which were rife around him in his day that were wicked, wickedness. And often it was things in the behavior and the work of those who were the most religious people. But there was that hatred, and one day, well, Jesus will be known by the whole world as someone who's against sin and is angry with it. But even then, that hatred and anger, it won't be malicious, out of control, comparable with a human being, you know, just being fiery and undignified and careless and going too far and seeming to make it personal in an unfair way against people. It won't be like that. It'll be a beautiful hatred even then. It's part of his character. He loves righteousness. He loves what should be loved. He hates what should be hated. He's in his wonderfulness and delightfulness and beauty. He's been set apart, anointed by God. And this psalm says he's been anointed with the oil of gladness. And Jesus was, in some ways, a paradox of being the most grieved and sad man, because there were things that grieved him in a way that others couldn't understand, but also the most happy man, because he had joys that people couldn't understand, and they were very great joys. And he can give us his joy. He is joyful now. And this speaks about him having the oil of gladness more than others. And he's someone who it's good to be with. The picture in verse 8 is that someone who smells good. Someone whose clothes smell nice. And even that smell has something royal about it, because he's coming from the ivory palaces, and the scents are from the ivory palaces. Let's just think about spending time with Jesus. It's not like spending time with someone who's, yes, very nice, but you don't mention it, but there is a strong smell. It's not like that at all. It's like spending time with somebody who everything about them is just good for you and leaves you feeling attracted to them. Something has flowed from them to you, perhaps including some pleasant smells that seem to sum up that person. Well, spending time with Jesus is compared with that. Being in the presence of one who is a sweet-smelling savour. It's good to be with him. Are these things just words to you? Do you know what I mean? Do you find Jesus wonderful, delightful, and beautiful? If you don't, is there a barrier? Is there something that you are looking to in your life to be your wonderful or your delightful or your beautiful thing or person and not Jesus? We need to see him for who he is. And sometimes the reason we're not seeing him for who he is, the reason these things might just sound like words and not touching our heart and not affecting us, is because we are feeding our minds and our hearts on anything else but him. And there are things we need to forget. And we need to look to Jesus. And we need to come before him, because he can make us see him as he is. He can make us realize how wonderful he is and how we need him to satisfy our hearts. Well, he is also a warrior. The action, if we just go back to verse 3, this is where the action starts, because it just starts with his character and his status. But then, gird your sword upon your thigh, O mighty one. And it's as if he's going to his wedding, but he's going as a warrior. There may have to be a fight on the way to this wedding. Well, there was, in a sense, wasn't there, for Jesus? Because there he went to Jerusalem, and he went having to fight temptation, and he went to the cross to fight the devil. And that was so that he could have a bride. That was so he could have us and have all kinds of people and so many people from all around the world. He had to go to the cross for us to fight Satan, to take away our sin and to take us out of the clutches of the devil, to redeem us. And he is a mighty and skillful warrior. It talks about his arrows being sharp. Verse 5, your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. Maybe not a very nice picture to us to start with. That sounds like a lethal thing. Arrows from this strong king going into his enemies, into their hearts. Well, that sounds dangerous. That sounds fatal. Would Jesus deliver a blow to someone and cause somebody's death if it was for the sake of righteousness and truth and humility? Well, yes. There will be a time when Jesus will deliver that mortal blow to the devil, as if striking him with an arrow. And for the devil, there will only be pain and death and punishment forever. And for all the devil's angels, and the Bible says, for all of us who are on the devil's side, there will be those sharp arrows. There will be that pain, that death, that punishment. And it's not my idea, and it's not what I'd want to say of my own accord. It's faithful to say so, and it's important to know it. It's not a good idea to be on the devil's side. It really is not a good idea, and a awful future awaits. But Jesus uses his arrows for something else as well. He uses his arrows maybe for some unwilling people like you. He uses his arrows to pierce into the hardness of heart that makes us unwilling to be his and want to stay on a side which is effectively the devil's side. If we find sometimes that Jesus, he seems to be hurting us, hurting our pride, perhaps by his word, perhaps by the way he's working in our lives, hurting our pride, hurting our plans, hurting our conscience. Well, you know, Jesus hurts so he can heal. He hurts his enemies, or people who are starting to act like his enemies, perhaps, just turning away from him, so that those people fall before him and then are healed and then belong to him and then gladly follow him. Now, he did this with a man called Saul of Tarsus, didn't he? You wouldn't want to know Saul of Tarsus, a horrible man, dangerous man who was killing people, killing Christians, on the way to Damascus to get more Christians taken away, put in prison, perhaps killed. And then Jesus sends down an arrow. Well, Jesus came himself and showed himself in that vision from heaven. And it was like an arrow in Paul's shoulder, that made him fall down on the ground, overwhelmed by the bright light of the vision of Jesus. And then Jesus sent an arrow into Saul's heart. That's when Jesus said the loving words, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And his arrows were sharp in the heart of Saul of Tarsus, and Saul was broken to surrender and love, and then followed Jesus and became part of the bride of Jesus, rejoicing in his glories. So those arrows, they do you good in the end. And Jesus is very skillful. He can send just the right arrow for the right person at the right time to bring them to feel that pain of their pride and their plans being hurt, their conscience being hurt, perhaps. And being affected by Jesus, knowing that they need to surrender to him. He is wonderful, delightful, and beautiful. He is a warrior. He is willing. He is a willing husband here in this psalm, a happy husband, a husband that loves his bride. And as he comes to her, it's as if she needs to listen to verse 10, forget your own people also and your father's house. And then verse 11, so the king will greatly desire your beauty. The king will look at you, turning his face to him, knowing that he now is your love. You're becoming one with him, and he will desire your beauty. He will see that as a wonderful and beautiful thing, that faith, that repentance in him. You will be clothed with beauty in his sight, given a perfect righteousness. And then you'll be beginning to be made into that image as he sanctifies you, and he will greatly desire your beauty. And he is willing to do that. He is willing to look at you with love and favor and delight, whoever you are. He is willing to make you his and be your bridegroom and make you part of the joy of eternity, the joy of heaven forever. Jesus is willing. Sometimes we are not willing, and sometimes we are only half willing. I wonder if I would ask you a question tonight. Are you willing for Jesus to be first in your life? Are you willing to spend time with him? Are you willing that the chief, highest and the biggest concerns in your life are Jesus' gospel, Jesus' people, his church, Jesus' will for you and his heart and his desires for you? Are you willing for those things be the biggest concerns? Then I don't know what the answer's going to be. But if we ask the question, is Jesus willing? Is he willing to receive you? Is he willing to satisfy you as you turn to him? Is he willing to be your joy and walk with you and give you everything? Then I know the answer to that one. The answer is yes, he is. He is willing. So forget. Forget things that are not of him. And turn to him. And he will, with desire and love and rejoicing, he'll look at you and he'll receive you. He'll see from heaven. And he'll help you. He'll help you to know how much he loves you. And new life in Christ is not boring. It's not painful suppression of your own desires all the time. No, you live out of love for Christ, the highest motivation. You don't know how joyful and how good it is unless you've started to live that life and walk with Christ. Well, lastly, he ought to be worshipped. He ought to be worshipped. Because he is your Lord, worship him. And that time when all the Lord's people together are brought to heaven, brought to the royal place, if you like, brought to where Christ belongs. And then there's a new creation, a new earth, which is heaven on earth, where Christ is and where all his people are. A great activity of that time will be worship. It talks about verse 15, people being with gladness and rejoicing brought and entering the king's palace. And then it speaks in verse 17, the people shall praise you forever and ever. And it's a wonderful thing to worship Christ. Now, this doesn't fit with a normal wedding, does it? Because he is your Lord, worship him. Now, for some people, it's bad enough that a woman has to say, I promise to love and cherish and honour and obey. Oh. But what about saying, you're my Lord and I will worship you? No, that's not appropriate for a human wedding, is it? But this is not a human wedding. This is a prophecy, and this is one of the details where it doesn't fit. Because he is your Lord, worship him. Jesus is so much to his people. If you're a Christian, he is your best friend. You can tell him your secrets. You can speak to him with a whisper about anything. He hears. You can walk with him through life, him by your side. He's like your older brother who knows what you're going to go through. He's your forerunner. He's been there first. He's your shelter. You can lean on him as your refuge. But he's also your God. And you worship him. And we can just be amazed that he's so high above us. And so different from us. Has such authority and power. The only Son of God. But he's also so condescending and comes to us. Comes to our hearts. Comes to our lives. Walks with us. Hears us. Is our shepherd, is our friend. But remember, he's your Lord, and worship him. Well, just to remind you of the importance of forgetting what comes in the way, what takes away your worship from Christ, what takes away your life, your time, your desires, your ambitions from Jesus himself. Forget it and look to him and be like Saul of Tarsus. Once he was struck with the arrow in his heart and he'd fell to the ground and then he'd said, who are you, Lord? And then he'd said, what do you want me to do? And he became a follower of Jesus. He then says in the book of Philippians, he says, the things that were gained to me, I've counted loss. I've suffered the loss of everything in my past life for Christ, and I just see them as rubbish, as mess, that I might win Christ, that I might know him, that I might be found in him. And my goal is that great day when I will, with resurrection life like Jesus, and with all the church, with all the people, I'll be joined to Christ and share in his glory.